Hello, and welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast in which Lowy Institute researchers and some of the world's leading experts delve into the big issues in international affairs. My name is Lydia Khalil, and I'm a research fellow at the Lowy Institute. Today, I'm speaking with journalist Zoe Daniel about her new book, Greetings from Trumpland. We will talk about the legacies of the Trump administration as we enter 2021 amid a global health pandemic and an epidemic of information manipulation and social and political division, and in the wake of his election loss to Joe Biden and the big lie that drove the Capitol siege. Zoe Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Trump is no longer in office. He's no longer on social media. We've escaped the daily onslaught of him and his disruptive narratives and policies. And a lot of people are really relieved to move on, myself included, having been exhausted by the Trump years. But your book argues that the impact of his administration runs deep. And my first question is, how deep? And why do we still need to be paying attention to him?
Yeah, it's been quite a relief not having the daily uncurated Twitter feed of Donald Trump, hasn't it, for the last couple of months? But I think that it could lull us into a false sense of security around this sort of feeling that Donald Trump has gone away, that that era is over. When 74 plus million people voted for Donald Trump in the 2020 election. So although you had a record number of people vote for Joe Biden, the second record number were people who voted for Donald Trump. So just because they didn't win the election doesn't mean they go away. And in fact, I think perhaps the reverse is true, that there is still simmering discontent in that group. Many of those people, I think, feel that Democrats never accepted Donald Trump as the president. They feel that their votes were seen as illegitimate from the 2016 election onwards, and that there was an ongoing campaign to remove him via the Russia probe and attempts at impeachment. And then just because in the end he lost the election in 2020, it doesn't mean that they just disappear. And I think you see, Lydia, Republicans grappling with that now as they try to keep those millions of Trump supporters in the tent, but also keep their moderates there as well. And it's a real problem for them as they try to move forward.
Yeah, you mentioned a few things there that I want to unpick a little bit. You know, back to those 74 million Trump supporters, you write that Trump's loyal supporters are more than disappointed. They're disbelieving. They're distrustful. I guess I would also ask, are they also delusional? Is their belief in the big lie that Trump really won the election some sort of greater, more concerning mass delusion that we're seeing in the United States? Or is it that example of extreme polarization and delegitimization of the opposing sides in the same way that you just mentioned that Trump supporters felt that Democrats didn't see Trump as legitimate?
Well, that pre-existing polarization, as you intimate, was there well before Donald Trump was elected. Well, what Donald Trump managed to do, though, as an arch populist, was to fan that, to mobilize that, and to sort of enable that politically. So, yes, potentially some of those or many of those supporters are delusional in some way, as well as being disappointed and in their own minds disenfranchised. I mean, they described themselves as the forgotten people before the 2016 election. They felt that winning that election validated them, that they were seen. But then even during that term of the Trump presidency, there was a sense of still lacking legitimacy because they felt that it wasn't embraced by the other side of politics that they had legitimately won that election. And then you add to that Donald Trump's deliberate fanning of distrust, the fragmentation of truths, and all of that really came home in the end, didn't it? When he spent that entire year in the lead up to the election in 2020, planting those seeds around the legitimacy of the vote. So that by the time we get to the post-election era, he was then able to deploy that lie to say, well, I told you that it was going to be illegitimate. I told you that there were going to be questionable things going on in the background. So you do have many Trump supporters who do believe that the election was stolen from him. And not only fringe members of the Trump supporting community, many of the what I would call sort of moderate Trump supporters also really deeply believe that he won the election.
And so in your book, You also recount a lot of examples of people that you came across during your tenure in America who were disenchanted with politics, as you said, disenfranchised, but who voted for Obama the first time around and perhaps even twice, and then went on to vote for Trump, many of them having said they were disillusioned with Obama. Have you stayed in touch with any of them? And what are they now saying about Trump? Have they also now lost faith in Trump in the way that they did with Obama, or are they still big believers?
They're largely still big believers, which is interesting. You know, with everything that happened at the end, particularly with what happened in January, you know, I think there are certainly a cohort of Trump supporters who feel that was a step too far, that was far over the line. So that did swing some people against him. But many of the Trump supporters that we interacted with, and there are two Trump supporters, particularly in the book, Dan Moore, who voted for Barack Obama and would class himself as a Democrat, who then voted for Donald Trump because he felt that he could revitalize areas of inland America that have lost their steel mills, for example, and manufacturing industries. And also Mike McMullen, who's a sort of dyed-in-the-wool traditional Republican who still is very deeply believing in Donald Trump. And I think that those people feel that it's work unfinished for Donald Trump, that he did deliver on many of the things that he said he would in their minds, and that it was a work in progress that was incomplete. And they have, to an extent, bought the line that he was pushed out of office illegitimately.
So again, that base of support, the Trump base of supporters, a lot of them from Middle America, which you've called Trumpland. You know, the argument is that this American heartland, right, it was struggling and hollowed out because of globalization and economic decline. And, you know, those two Trump supporters that you mentioned are really emblematic of that. They turn to Trump as an alternative. But one of the things I've always wondered about, you know, there are a lot of other constituencies and working class groups in America who were equally as impacted by that decline in stable working class jobs, and who were part of the losing group of globalization, but who did not support him. And mostly those were poor and working class minority communities. So what explains that disparity?
I mean, I think a lot of the analysis has shown that you do have a racial division to some degree in who supports Donald Trump. And obviously many of those communities that we're talking about in the flyover states of America are majority white communities who, as well as being threatened by globalization in a world trade context and cheap labor internationally, have also seen huge technological change have an effect on industries that were generational in their communities. There's a sense in my mind that they were kind of grasping for something. And perhaps to some degree, Dan Moore is a good example. They grasped for Barack Obama, who promised hope. But then after 8 years of Obama, and this is partly the fault of partisan politics in the US, they still felt disappointed. So then there was a sense of, okay, let's go for the anti-establishment politician, the disruptor, the anti-politician, really. And that 2016 election, in a way, was kind of the perfect storm for me, in that it came off the back of 8 years of Obama. Maybe some of the people in those predominantly white communities were sort of backlashing against Obama and so swinging towards Trump. But there was also a sense that as Hillary Clinton came in as the candidate, who is, you know, really the archetypal establishment candidate other than being female, against the absolute disruptor candidate, that created a situation where you had very stark choices for people. And so you ended up with a real divergence there.
Right. So I guess what I'm hearing you say is that in the beginning, perhaps they may or may not have been motivated by some sort of racial consideration. But as we've seen the way that the Trump presidency kind of flirted with white supremacists and inflamed racial tensions, and as the Black Lives Matter movement really gained prominence in the demonstrations, were the greatest mass demonstrations in the United States toward the end of last year. Did you see a slide toward a more racial reckoning and a racial aspect of the support for Donald Trump among the majority white community in the United States?
Well, I think what you could argue is that Donald Trump enabled views that had been under the surface to be voiced. And there is a lot of discussion about the loss of civility, for example, under Trump. So I think it goes a lot further than loss of political correctness. People who have views that would have previously been regarded as not only distasteful, but really untenable to voice publicly, suddenly felt that they could. And throughout the Trump administration, you saw an increase in racial violence. You saw an increase in anti-Semitic attacks, for example, and his deliberate failure to call out white supremacy, his equivocation on those issues after Charlottesville, for example, the fatal protest in which a peaceful protester was killed at a race rally. You know, he deliberately mobilized that because he knew that those people were within his support base. He needed to keep them there. So in that sense, it's a process of, if we talk about a lot of the Trump presidency was about legitimizing and delegitimizing things, one of the things that he legitimized was racism. And then you end up with pre-existing polarization on that issue, which comes to the surface. It's not as if Black Lives Matter didn't exist before Donald Trump or those sentiments didn't exist, but it's the enabling of those sentiments and the validation of those people who suddenly felt that it was okay to be that way.
Yes, he certainly expanded the Overton window of acceptable speech out in public. And a more acceptable bandwidth, I think, within the Republican Party. And that's where I want to ask you next. You say that Trump ransacked the Republican Party. I like that imagery. I think it's pretty descriptive and pretty accurate. And in your book, you recount, instance after instance of Republicans at first opposing Trump and then coming back simpering toward him. Mm. What's going on there? What was that? Is it was an electoral calculation that his hold over the Republican base was so strong? Or have the principles and the narratives of the Republican Party really shifted?
Well, unfortunately, it's about winning, isn't it? And it's about power. So, I think it was almost forgotten during that whole blur of the Trump era how much antipathy there was towards him even winning the nomination in the first place. You know, many of the senior members of the Republican Party overtly spoke out against Trump, didn't even attend the Republican National Convention. I mean, you had Lindsey Graham, who ended up becoming one of his biggest supporters, calling him out as a xenophobe over his early intentions to build a wall along the Mexican border. And then, as I say, Lindsey Graham became one of the people who spoke out most strongly in Donald Trump's favor throughout his presidency. Ted Cruz, another good example, who was attacked by Donald Trump verbally in various ways, was booed off the stage at the Republican National Convention for not endorsing him, and then miraculously came out and did endorse him. And then amid the events of January 6th, appeared to sort of defend Donald Trump in a way. So, those people, if Trump supporters are accused by Democrats of kind of shelving their scruples for the sake of what they thought he could deliver them, many Republicans did the same thing. And now we have this issue of the post-Trump era where they still want to have a bit each way because they know how much power he has in the support base that he holds. Because those 74 million people, okay, so many of them are obviously Republicans, but they're not necessarily traditional Republicans. Many of them are kind of a new set of voters. And as Republicans observe the huge changing demographics in the United States, racial demographics, age demographics, even shifting of, you know, working and professional classes, and just who those people vote for compared to the way they might have voted traditionally. They need those people. And so it's a question of, to what extent do you stick to your principles and lose elections, or to what extent do you kind of pause them so that you can win, thinking that maybe you can manage the situation once you've got your candidate into the White House. But, you know, as we know, Donald Trump proved very difficult to manage.
So does that mean that the Republican Party has become the Trump Party? I mean, it used to be that the Republican Party considered itself a broad church. It seems that it's no longer the case, that it's just narrowed down to people who believe in Trumpism.
Well, I don't know if it is. I mean, I think there's a real schism in the Republican Party now. And, you know, I think, you know, from a sort of observational point of view, not being American, it's very interesting, or it will be very interesting to watch over the next few years to see, well, what happens to the Republican Party? What is its identity? How do they keep those moderates in the tent, as well as Donald Trump's supporters? Also, how do you manage that even at a sort of politically strategic point of view, when you might need Donald Trump sort of as a figure to win the primaries for candidates to get them into Congress or into the Senate, but it might lose you the presidential election once you've got a sort of first past the post situation where people are literally deciding between Trumpism and non-Trumpism. So there's a lot of interesting dynamics there. I mean, Democrats have an identity problem too, as they see their working class voters drifting conservative because they're no longer sort of the party for the unions, same as the ALP in Australia. And they're also catering to their professional middle and upper classes in the large coastal cities. So both sides of politics are actually struggling with who they are and just, you know, how they describe themselves.
Right. So you alluded to some of the similar dynamics happening in Australia here with politics that we see in the United States and have seen over the years. How much of Trumpism has seeped into Australian politics?
Well, I think the most obvious thing is the use of fake news as cover for inconvenient truths. You know, it's very easy for leaders, isn't it? And not only in Australia, but we've seen it happen all over the world, to push back against questions about bad behavior or failures by saying, oh, that's just fake news, to delegitimize the question and to avoid answering it. As a journalist, I think this is really concerning, the fact that facts have become a matter of opinion. That enables all sorts of manipulation at a leadership level and makes it more and more difficult to keep leaders accountable. But you've also seen in various countries, leaders adopt Donald Trump's sort of particular brand of populism, his sort of rock star rallies, his, you know, very direct appeal to people on the margins to try to bring them into a sort of engaged group of voters. Brazil is a good example of that. And the other thing I think that's relevant in the Australian context versus the US is the increasingly partisan media environment. The US is an interesting case study when it comes to media because it has such a large population, so it can support very partisan media outlets. And what that means is that people only really consume what they already believe. They're unlikely to listen to, hear, or read anything that differs from their opinion. So you don't get that range of point of views, or you don't get forced into a position where you have to consider someone else's point of view. And increasingly in Australia, unfortunately, I think something similar is happening. And it also creates a situation, especially as broadcast media organisations increasingly move towards commentators rather than straight reporting, that the media becomes a tool, an inflammatory tool, rather than an explanatory tool.
Yes, certainly Trump's treatment of the media was problematic in a lot of ways, helped push us toward this post-fact environment. But Trump and the media seem to have this symbiotic relationship. You know, his antics brought eyeballs to the screens. It sold papers during a time when the industry was declining. So in hindsight, after covering that for so long, how do you make of how the media covered Trump? And do you think the way that the media covered him fueled his rise? Do you think the media let Trump set the agenda in the conversation? Or do you think it was a bit more complicated than that?
Well, there's a few things to unpack there. I mean, I definitely think that Donald Trump, before he was elected, he had already tested out how to manipulate the media in various ways. One of the examples that we use is the birther movement around whether Barack Obama was born in the United States. Donald Trump was quite a key protagonist in this. And in my mind, he kind of used that as a little bit of a testing ground to see who would believe him and which members of the media or which networks would sort of allow him free rein to spout mistruths, in a sense. He then moved into the presidency, utilized chaos theory very adeptly to run the national and in many ways global conversation and to completely control the narrative. And it's very difficult, not only as a journalist, but as even a member of the public, but as another politician, to run your own agenda or look at anything in another direction when all you're trying to do is keep up with the chaos. And Donald Trump did that very adeptly, in part during the campaign, but particularly in the first year or two of his presidency, where, you know, all we were doing was reacting to his Twitter feed, reacting to a revolving door of sacked staff, reacting to his sort of shake-up of entrenched global policies or leadership conventions or whatever they might be. So it made it very difficult to sort of focus in on anything in any detail. And I think that in an environment of fairly depleted media as well, in an industry that's under pressure, there were a lot of media organisations that were just chronically under-resourced. So they found it very hard to keep up with in a relentless environment. But as you suggest, because he actually increased the profitability of media organisations in many ways, they were then able to actually put on staff to address some of these issues. So I think they've vastly improved at tackling it by the end of his presidency. You saw, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN and such put on hundreds, thousands of journalists to fact check Donald Trump. Then in the end, of course, he lost his uncurated megaphone on Twitter, which really enabled him, you know, once the media started catching up with him and fact checking him and critiquing him and contradicting him, he still was able to fall back on that. But once that was taken away, that made it very difficult for him.
It seems that Donald Trump and his presidency had that relationship with a lot of dynamics. So in the same way that the media reacted to him, we saw that his presidency also fueled a rise of other counter movements. You know, I think the Me Too movement is front of mind. It didn't start with Donald Trump, but his presidency and the way that he spoke about women and the accusations leveled against him of his treatment toward women helped fuel that movement. Similarly, like we spoke earlier about the Black Lives Matter movement, do you think that there are other dynamics like that that have been a net positive in terms of being a reaction towards some of the negative things that his presidency pulled in?
Well, I mean, those two, as you say, there's sort of a weird reverse way of looking at those things to say, well, they brought those things to the top. You know, it created increased conversation and focus on those things rightly, and that's a net positive. The recognition of how dangerous the information manipulation is, I think, is potentially a net positive. I think that's still a work in progress, but I think, you know, there is increasing understanding in the mainstream now that what pops up on someone's Facebook page may well not be right. No, I don't think people consume perhaps as gullibly as they did before. And an exposure of the fragility of democracy, I think, is not a bad thing either. You know, it's not as if it's the first time it's happened in world history. We've seen this cycle happen many times. But in this case, what happened on January 6th, which was sort of, you know, the final result of all of that fragmenting of trust and truth that we've talked about, shocked people to the extent that they had to really think about whether democracy was automatic. And then I guess on a positive note, you could say, well, in the end, Donald Trump did move on. Joe Biden was inaugurated and is now the president. So that's a victory, the democratic process. But again, I still feel like that's a bit of a work in progress when we consider that all of those tens of millions of people who voted for Donald Trump are still there. And for me, the most important thing actually is that despite the acrimony between the opposing political forces, that there needs to be a way of bringing about conversation between these two groups, because you see people sort of going even further to the margins in regard to their attitudes and also talking about media, what they're consuming, or the sorts of conspiracy theories that they might be absorbing themselves in that are way outside the mainstream on those fringes.
So you also covered Donald Trump's foreign policy in addition to his domestic politics and policies in the United States. Do you think there was actually a Trump foreign policy, or was it a fly-by-the-seat-of-his-pants reactionary type of maneuverings that he did on the foreign stage? Was there actually any Trump doctrine or rhyme or reason to his foreign policy decisions?
Well, the only doctrine that I can think of in that regard is I need to do it better than my predecessors did. You know, I need to fix stuff and put a big tick against things that I've fixed, particularly in line with his contract with the American voter, which, for example, promised pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement, pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. This sense of no one else has been able to develop a good relationship with Vladimir Putin, so I will do that. No one else has been able to solve the issues on the Korean Peninsula, so I will be the first president to have a face-to-face meeting, or the first sitting president to have a face-to-face meeting with Kim Jong-un and step into North Korea. Plainly, in that instance, well, that's completely evaporated and really led to not much, other than perhaps the North Koreans continuing to develop their nuclear program under the cover of that. But in Donald Trump's mind, that is a big tick. And, you know, in the minds of many of his voting base, it would be too, because all they'll remember is the bright lights and the flashing cameras of those meetings taking place, rather than what the long-term impact of that might have been.
Well, you inadvertently got sucked into a foreign policy issue with President Trump and Australia as well, about the reporting of the refugee swap deal. How did that feel, and what did it feel like as a journalist to kind of be sucked into a dynamic around foreign policy negotiations?
Well, it was just a very strange set of circumstances, in that it was very soon after Donald Trump was inaugurated and he had announced the travel bans on people from Muslim majority countries coming into the US. And we had just been to Chicago, where the airport was in a form of chaos because people's visas had been frozen and there was mass confusion about who could come in and such. And at the same time, Malcolm Turnbull, who was the then Australian Prime Minister, had had a conversation with Donald Trump and had gone public saying that the president said that the deal made by Barack Obama to take refugees from Australian detention centres would go ahead. I kind of stepped into this perhaps naively when I went to the White House press room and asked the press secretary, Sean Spicer, well, this seems odd, because these people are from the same countries that the president has just banned. So is the deal going ahead or not? And Spicer answered that yes, it would. But obviously the president was watching the press conference, because I then got a call from someone else in the White House saying, no, the president, or Mr. Trump's really annoyed about this. He's not happy with it. He hasn't yet decided if it's happening or not. So we then went with that story. Speaking of fake news, Malcolm Turnbull then went on television in Australia suggesting that our sources weren't solid and that it wasn't good journalism. But it became apparent the next day what had actually happened when the transcript of the conversation between Malcolm Turnbull and Donald Trump was leaked, in which the president accused Malcolm Turnbull of trying to export the next Boston bombers, called it a dumb deal, and yeah, the whole thing sort of blew up into a major diplomatic incident. So it was kind of emblematic of a lot of things, actually. Confusion in the White House, very unusual channels of receiving information, and the way Donald Trump was going to conduct his interactions with foreign leaders, which was unorthodox to say the least.
Well, Zoe Daniel, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast from the Lowy Institute hosted by our experts with production assistance from Jennifer Reinhart. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to joining you for the next episode of Lowy Institute Conversations.